I've often thought there's these seven things that people have to get approximately right. You know, we went through some of them. You need an intimate relationship, family, job or career. You have to take care of yourself mentally and physically, your health. You have to regulate your drug and alcohol use. You have to use your work time productively outside of work. There's one other I often mention. I can't remember it now. It's an arbitrary list in some sense, but if you don't have a list, it's a good one. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can pick one of those things and work on them. And if you have all of those things, your life is likely to be better. You know, maybe you're a true radical and you have to live in a way that isn't traditional, and you don't need any of that. Highly improbable that that's true. And God only knows how you're going to find your own way. But until you know that for certain, it's not such a bad idea to adopt an apprenticeship in at least one of these areas. And you know, the purpose of being an apprentice isn't so that you're a slave, it's so that you become capable of your masterpiece, of transcending the discipline. So the idea is, look, there's lots of disciplinary strategies, there's lots of games you could play. And so you can fall into a moral relativism, say, well, all games are equal. It's like, well, no, but even if that's true, the fact that you need a game, that isn't relative. That's true. You need a game. Pick a game. Which game? Anyone is better than none. Play it hard. See what happens. You'll change as a consequence of the pursuit. And I think you have to be in very dire straits before that won't work. You can be in straits that are so dire that you can't move forward. But generally, you're somewhere that you could improve in some manner.
Is getting people to believe that, is that harder than actually doing it in some ways? That we seem to be, there's so many young people that just feel so lost that just getting them, just convincing them to do it is in some ways more important than doing it.
Well, I don't think you can convince them exactly, but you can ask them. It's like, okay, well, think about your life. And I do think I address this directly in that chapter. Remember sometime you accomplished something difficult. Well, was that good or not? And generally, the human experience, as far as I can tell, is that when you've accomplished something difficult, you regard that as worthwhile. So then you say, and this is a therapeutic technique in some sense, because you don't try to convince people, you get them to look at their own experience. It's like, well, it turns out that in your life, when you've done something that stretched you beyond where you were, so that was difficult, that you regarded that as worthwhile. Okay, so let's assume that that's true and that can be duplicated.
Most people have problems in living. They don't have psychological problems. And so I've experienced, despite my love for the psychoanalysts, very frequently what I'm doing as a therapist is helping people have a life that would work. You know, and you can parameterize that. It's like, what do you need? How about some friends? That people kind of like that. How about an intimate relationship with someone that you can trust that maybe has a future? That'd be good. How about a career that puts you in a dominance hierarchy somewhere? So at least you've got some possibility of rising, some possibility of stabilizing yourself. And a schedule and a routine, because no one can live without a routine. You just forget that. If you guys don't have a routine, I would recommend, like, you get one going, because you cannot be mentally healthy without a routine. You need to pick a time to get up, whatever time you want, but pick one and stick to it, because otherwise you dysregulate your circadian rhythms and they regulate your mood. And eat something in the morning. I've had lots of clients who've had anxiety disorders. I had one client who was literally starving. Very smart girl. There was very little that she liked. She kind of tried to subsist on like half a cup of rice a day. She came to me and said, I have no energy. I come home. All I want to do is watch the same movie over and over. What, like, is that weird? And I thought, well, it depends on how hard you work. You know, it's a little weird, but whatever. It's familiar. You're looking for comfort. So I did an analysis of her diet. It's like 3/4 of a cup of rice. It's like, you're starving. Eat something. You know, you'll feel better. So She modified her diet and all her anxiety went away and she had some energy. It's like, yeah, you gotta eat. So, a schedule, that's a good thing, man. Your brain will thank you for it. It will stabilize your nervous system. With a bit of a plan, that's a good thing. You need a career, you need something productive to do with your time. You need to regulate your use of drugs and alcohol, most particularly alcohol, because that does in a lot of people. You need a family, like the family you have, your parents and all that. It'd be nice if you all got along. You could work on that. That's a good thing to work on. And then, you know, you probably need children at some point. And that's life. That's what life is. And if you're missing, you know, you may have a good reason to not be operating on one of those dimensions. It's not mandatory. But I can tell you that if you're not operating reasonably well on four, I think I mentioned six, if you're not operating reasonably well on at least three of them, there's no way you're going to be psychologically thriving. And that's more pragmatic in some sense than psychological, right? Human beings have a nature. There's things we need. And if we have them, well, that's good. And if we don't have them, well, then we feel the lack. And so behaviorists, behavioral psychologists concentrate a lot more on that sort of thing. You know, it's practical. It's like strategizing. Make a career plan. Figure out how to negotiate, because that's bloody important. Figure out how to say what you need. Figure out how to tell the truth to people. Figure out how to listen to your partner in particular, because if you listen to them, they will actually tell you what they want. And sometimes you can give it to them, and maybe they'll return the favor. And if you practice that for like 15 years, well, then maybe you're constantly giving each other what you want. Well, hooray, that would be good. And then there's two of you under both circumstances, and it's better to have two brains than one, because people think differently because of their temperament mostly. And so the negotiation is where the wisdom arises, and it's part of the transformation, the psychological transformation that's attendant on an intimate relationship, and one of the fundamental purposes of a long-term intimate relationship.
Try to make one room in your home as beautiful as possible. See something around you.
I think that might be my favorite chapter.
Yeah. Well, you've got some interesting artistic taste.
Yeah, I suppose. That's a chapter about the value of beauty as a marker for the transcendent. And it's great. You want to establish a relationship with things that sustain you. Truth, the great verities, truth, beauty. Beauty is difficult to define, but it's an invitation to the transcendent, essentially. Because beauty speaks of the ideal, and it impacts you beyond thought. It's visceral beauty, and that's an indication of the power of the ideal. And if you try to establish a relationship with beauty, and so to do that, you can make one corner of your room beautiful, if you can. You start to play with the idea of beauty. You start to learn to discriminate between what's beautiful and what isn't. And then you invite that into your life. And that's a terrifying thing to some degree, because beauty is very powerful, partly because it reminds you of who you aren't. But it's amazingly worthwhile. And it's sort of the next step beyond cleaning up your room. You know, make it orderly, but then the next step is make it beautiful.
So you're done being someone that you were. A school kid. You're done with that. And so that's an achievement, but it's also the end of something. It's the end of an identity, and it's a new beginning. So now you have a new beginning. You have a new beginning. You don't get that many of those in your life.
Mm-hmm.
If you move, if you switch jobs, if you make a radical life transformation, you may have that. Sometimes that's accidental. It's thrust upon you. That's different. That's harder. Sometimes it's because of opportunity, but maybe you get four or five opportunities like that in your life. So they're rare. You get to be someone new. Who? Have a vision. So when I started to puzzle this out, it was often because of talking to clients or students who didn't know what to do. What should I do with my life? I don't know what to do with my life. Fair enough. And that's not a very good question. What do I do with my life? It's like, what's the answer to everything? It's not a good question, right? It's too vague. So I suppose I answered this to some degree, at least initially, like a conservative person. I said, well, what other people do? Well, they have an intimate relationship. They have a family. So that could be your birth family, so you could fix that up. Or it could be, you know, your new family, your kids, your wife. They have friends. They have a social community. That might involve civic responsibility, which is something we're direly lacking at the moment. You need a job. You need to take care of yourself mentally and physically. You need to educate yourself. You need to regulate your reaction to temptation. There's eight things. Okay, so now you get to be whoever you want, but you have to want it and you have to aim at it. And so to do that, you have to have a vision. Part of the utility of literature is the provision of such visions. Negative, you know, in the case of antiheroes, positive in the case of protagonists. Who could you be? Part of the advantage of being educated in the humanities is that you can draw your models from the best history has to offer. And that's really what an education in humanity should present you with. It's like, here are the great people of history, and that's you in potential. And so that means you can establish a new peer group. You know, in some sense, my peer group has always been the people whose books I most admired. You know, and that's a reach, right? Because who dares to compare himself, herself to the truly great people of the past? Nietzsche for me, Dostoevsky, Jung, and then the classic philosophers like Plato and Aristotle and Kant and Hume, all these stunning people that were brilliant beyond conception. You know, I mean, that's a high reach and presumptuous in some sense. But the point of a humanities education is in large part to surround yourself with peers of the highest quality. And then you also want to do that with your peers. So one of the things you want to ask yourself if you're graduating from high school is, well, now I'm off to do something else. Might be a job, might be college, might be trade school. It's like, I'm going to make new friends. What's a friend? What do I want? I want someone to tell good news to who will celebrate with me. I want someone to tell bad news to who will be upset that something bad happened to me and not secretly happy. I want someone who's aiming up for me and for them. Or not. Or do you not want that? It's like, what do you want if you're taking care of yourself? What would you want in a relationship? You need a vision for this. And we do a staggeringly appalling job of helping young people even understand that that's necessary. And I know partly why. I was very curious about this because I spent a lot of time with this future authoring program, self-authoring, part of the self-authoring suite, because we built a program to help people make a plan. And once we built the program, one of the things we found, for example, was that if you gave it to young men who were entering college the few months before they went to college, they were 50% less likely to drop out in the first year.
That's crazy.
For a 90-minute exercise, it's like, that's just... the world had any sense, every single college would have immediately used that upon publication of our paper. But none of them did. And that says something.
Is that mainly just goal setting? Like, what do you want? Well, envision that and then...
I think goal setting is the wrong way to think about it. I think it's too narrow a conceptualization. I think that you need literally to imagine it. It's like you get to be who you want. Well, you need to run the story, like, in detail. And if you're trying to predict whether someone's going to commit suicide, you ask them, well, you know, have you ever thought about harming yourself? Well, you know, sometimes. Have you ever thought about killing yourself? Well, you know, the thoughts crossed my mind. Do you have a plan? Yeah, I have a plan. Well, can you tell me about the plan? Well, you know, my dad has a 45 in the top shelf of his desk. I've seen it in there several times. The bullets are in the drawer next door. I thought, you know, I could probably put that in my mouth in the bathroom so I didn't make too much of a mess, and probably do that in the morning.
That's
like, that's not good.
Yeah.
Right. That person's
that's
in danger. Yeah, because they've, the dream has entered their mind. They've visualized it. And so I don't, it's not goal setting. It's more like, it's much more like casting yourself in a fully fleshed out literary representation. It's like, what is your future? Who are you? And what you want to do is negotiate with yourself. It's like, just imagine, this is a gospel idea, right? That if you knock, the door will open. If you ask, you will receive. If you seek, you will find. And no one believes that. But I believe it's true.
Yeah, me too.
But it depends on what you mean by knock, ask, and seek. Because it means if you mean it.
Yeah, if your life depends on it.
Yeah, that's basically. Right. That's right. You're all in on it. It's like, you want this? What do you mean
want?
You
don't kind of want.
No, that's
right. You don't
right.
want for like 2 minutes of the day and then you get bored.
Right, right. And your right hand wants it and your left hand doesn't. And no, it doesn't mean that at all. It means you're going to make the sacrifices necessary and you're all in on it. Okay, so then the question becomes, well, what's worth going all in on? And the answer to that is, ask yourself.
One of the things I tell young people all the time, I'm not a very typical psychologist in this regard, because psychologists like to pat people on the head and say, you're all right the way you are. I talked to Bishop Barron a while ago, I'm going to broadcast this, and he said that the Catholic priests were trained in the 1960s to kind of be accepting, you know, humanistically, mm-hmm. you're okay the way you are, you know. And that's such rubbish. It's like... Not only are you not okay the way you are, you don't think that anybody else is okay the way they are either. And you don't think your children are okay the way they are. Like, you love them and all that, but you don't want them to stay 3 years old their entire life. You want them to expand and improve and become who they are. And so, instead of telling young people that they're okay the way they are, I tell them that, and it's a terrible message for them if they're desperate. You know, so let's say 10% of the people in my audience are young, maybe they're young men, just for the sake of argument, and they're like not in good shape. They don't have any goals. They're drinking too much. They're watching pornography all the time. They've got no aim. They've got no structure in their life, and they're just bloody miserable. And the misery is twisting them into malevolence, because enough misery will absolutely do that to you. And then what are you going to do? And come along and say, well, you're okay the way you are? It's like, that's the last thing they want to hear. It's like, get your damn act together. You know, you got things to do and they're going to be difficult. And that there's an echoing Christian message in there, I would say, which is you pick up the weight of your suffering voluntarily and you walk uphill with it. And that not only gives you the meaning that you need in your life, to stop you from degenerating in a dangerous manner, but it actually makes things better. And so that all has to be part of it. Like, I believe in human ingenuity. I think we can solve all the problems that beset us, but it can't just be, it has to be more than we can enhance material well-being, which is what it tends to be now. It's not enough.
You might say, well, what might you replace an ideology with? And I would say, well, a differentiated view of and strategy for life. And so when I work with my clients, I never start with high order problems to begin with, like, how do I orient myself spiritually? So let's just leave that aside for a second, okay? We'll return to it. So what do you need to get straight in your life? Well, you need a job or a career. Career, preferably, perhaps. The advantage to a job is that you do it for 8 hours, let's say, and you're done, right? With a career, you're in it all the time. Now, you'll make more money, you'll advance up the economic hierarchy, but you're never done with work if you have a career. And maybe that's what you want. But in any case, you have to have a job or a career. Why? Well,
you don't want to starve. You want to take care of yourself and the people that are dependent on you. There are practical, obvious practical reasons, but there are psychological reasons too. I mean, a job gives you something to do every day, just as your career does. And it also addresses the deep human need to be of value and service to other people. And so that needs to be attended to. So if you're a young person, it's like, okay, have a plan. You need a job and a career. It would be good if it was something that you could be competent at. So the smarter you are, pure IQ, the more complex job you can manage. And then if you add the development of discipline to that, so that's the development of conscientiousness, that can further you. So you need conscientiousness and intelligence to be competent. And the more hardworking you are and the more intelligent, the more complex the job you can manage. So if you're of average intelligence, which you've probably figured out by the time you're 18 or so, it's going to be very, very difficult for you to be a high-end corporate lawyer unless you work insanely hard. So your better bet is to pick a profession that isn't so cognitively demanding, that's still useful. And trades are great as far as I'm concerned. It's not like tradespeople aren't skilled, and it's not like trades don't require intelligence. I am not saying that. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't require as much abstraction, generally speaking. Like if you want to be a lawyer, you have to be hyper literate and like 90th percentile literate fundamentally. And you have to be able to formulate verbal arguments or you're going to get crushed by someone who can do it. Okay, so job and career, you need a plan. Okay, education. You should be as educated as you are intelligent. You should have a plan for that.
Yeah.
Okay. And it should continue because things change quick and you better keep up. Okay. So you should have a vision of that. People don't seem to do well without an intimate relationship. It'd be good if you could have a family and bring peace to the family that you have, because family is important, extraordinarily important. Those connections, so intimate relationship and family, whether that's your parents, your siblings, or the family that you start, you need a plan for that and a vision of that. You have to take care of your physical and mental health. You have to regulate your drug and alcohol intake. You have to figure out how to make productive and meaningful use of the time that's allotted to you outside of your obligations. That's extraordinarily useful. And you have to address your philosophical or spiritual / aesthetic yearnings, such as they might be. Well, so that's better than an ideology, a plan.
Sure, right.
Now, you know, and as you climb up your career, as you expand your competence and power, well, then you can get involved in larger scale transformations if that's where your interest takes you. And so with job and career, you should be competent and interested in it. That's a good pathway to success. I had already concluded intellectually that there was nothing good about nihilism and bitterness and resentment, that it was unbelievably dangerous, and that it isn't justified under any circumstances. And then I entered these extreme circumstances and I thought, oh, well, this justifies it. It's like, I can't see how anybody could be in this situation and not shake their fist at God and in outrage. But I really, really thought it through and talked to my wife about it. And all I could conclude was that was wrong, is that it didn't justify it. There was nothing good in it. There was nothing helpful in it. All it was doing was hurting me. It was interfering with whatever good I still might be able to do in the world. You know, the last chapter of my new book is Be Grateful in Spite of Your Suffering. And that was a chapter I, you know, worked on and was doubtful about and returned to and was like thoroughly what irate about and felt hypocritical about and so on and so forth, the full gamut of emotional responses. But it's the right thing to do, to be grateful. It's and I'm not claiming this for myself. Mm-hmm. It's tightly allied with a kind of existential courage. It's a decision. And, you know, undoubtedly there are people who've been pushed farther in the domain of pain than me. burn victims. People, you know, suffer unimaginable agony. And I would never dare to compare my pain to someone else's extraordinary pain. It was certainly far worse than every day that I spent in the last 2 years was worse than any day I had before that by a huge margin. For me, it was, well, like I said, if it had got any more extreme, I can't imagine that I would have lived through it. But the so the first conclusion was you still, under those conditions, you orient yourself upward and you try to do good in the world, and you don't, if you fall prey to resentment and anger and hostility, however justified, not even however rationalized, but however justified, even if an objective observer would say, well, no wonder you feel that way, it's not helpful.
So there is no good in it. That's what you said.
I see no good in it.
But then I wonder, like I would agree with you. I'm inclined to agree with that, that there's no good in that. But you know, through, you know, there's the old cliched adage about going through hard times, revealing certain silver linings and certain benefits that you may not see in the moment. So are you open to that possibility of in the future, some realization?
Well, I guess that this thing we already discussed, I would say, is of benefit. Whether that benefit justifies what I went through, I would say, would I repeat what I went through and still going through for that matter? I mean, I've only been feeling somewhat better for 5-6 days. I wouldn't repeat it to learn that.
Well, and maybe you're still learning something. Maybe there's still something that's to come, some realization. I mean, I'm not saying that's the case.
I know you're not. Yeah. Well, God only knows, right? I mean,
God knows.
It wasn't until this last week that I really thought that through and realized that however extreme my pain, which was diffuse, it didn't justify resentment. It didn't justify ingratitude. It didn't certainly didn't make those things work. But then the other thing that I did realize was, and people have commented on that being a difference between this book and the first book. The second book is more communitarian. There's less humor in it because I just wasn't up to humor, you know. But there's more emphasis on cooperation and the social role in ethical behavior. And I think that's partly a consequence of me observing how far above the call of duty my friends and my family went while they were caring for me. And not only my friends and my family, but medical personnel and the general public who've been my viewers, readers, and listeners, let's say, have been unbelievably loyal and supportive. And so I've seen this outpouring of love from, you know, at the micro level within my family and from my friends and from people I don't know, but who I communicate with, that saved my life for sure. There's no doubt about that. Multiple times, many, many times. The reason I emphasize individual responsibility, there's two reasons. One is, well, you can start right now, right where you are, no matter what you're doing. So you have that at hand. Second, if you become more responsible, you probably won't hurt anyone by doing it, right? It removes the convenience of the enemy. And that's given how terrible it is for us to generate, say, class-based explanations of enmity or racial-based explanations of enmity. That's something we really have to step carefully around. I mean, the worst crimes the human race has ever committed have been generated by class-based hypotheses of malevolence, class or ethnicity-based hypotheses of malevolence. It's terrible. And we need to avoid that. And I don't see that adopting more individual responsibility, even though it's not a cure-all, it doesn't, that's one danger it doesn't pose, in my estimation.
If you ask a disagreeable person what he wants, say, or she wants, they'll tell you right away. They know. It's like, this is what I want, and this is how I'm going to get it. But agreeable people, especially if they're really agreeable, are so agreeable that they often don't even know what they want, because they're so accustomed to living for other people and to finding out what other people want and to trying to make them comfortable and so forth, that it's harder for them to find a sense of their own desires as they move through life. And that's not, look, there's situations where that's advantageous, but it's certainly not advantageous if you're going to try to forge yourself a career. That just doesn't work at all. And so even though on average men and women aren't that much different in terms of their levels of agreeableness by the group, if you go out and you look at the extremes, they're very different. So all of the most agreeable people are women, and all of the most disagreeable people are men. And the thing is, the extremes are often what matter rather than what's in the middle. And so one of the ways that's reflected in society, by the way, is there's way more men in prison. And the best personality predictor of being imprisoned is to be low in agreeableness. It makes you callous. Now, you may think, well, what's the opposite of compassion and politeness? And the answer to that is, I think it's best sort of conceptualized as a trading game. So let's say that we're going to play repeated trading games. And if you're very agreeable, then you're going to bargain harder on my behalf than you're going to bargain on your own behalf. Whereas if you're very disagreeable, you're going to do the reverse. You're going to think, I'm in this trading game for me, and you are going to take care of your own interests, where an agreeable person is going to say, no, at best, this is, at worst, this has to be 50-50, but I'd like to help you every way I can. One of the things you have to be careful of if you're agreeable is not to be exploited, because you'll line up to be exploited. And I think the reason for that is because you're wired to be exploited by infants. And so that just doesn't work so well in that actual world. And one of the things that happens very often in psychotherapy, you know, people come to psychotherapy for multiple reasons, but one of them is they often come because they're too agreeable. And so what they get is so-called assertiveness training, although it's not exactly assertiveness that's being trained. What it is the ability to learn how to negotiate on your own behalf. And one of the things I tell agreeable people, especially if they're conscientious, is say what you think. Tell the truth about what you think. There's going to be things you think that you think are nasty and harsh, and they probably are nasty and harsh, but they're also probably true. And you need to bring those up to the forefront and deliver the message. And it's not straightforward at all, because agreeable people do not like conflict. Not at all. They smooth the water. You know, and you can see why that is, in accordance with the hypothesis that I've been putting forward. You don't want conflict around infants. It's too damn dangerous. You don't want fights to break out. You don't want anything to disturb the relative peace. You know, and if you're also more prone to being hurt physically and perhaps emotionally, you're also maybe loath to engage in the kind of high-intensity conflict that will solve problems in the short term. Because it takes a lot of conflict to solve problems in the short term. And, you know, if that can spiral up to where it's dangerous, which it can if it gets uncontrolled, it might be safer in the short term to keep the waters smooth and to not delve into those situations where conflict emerges. The problem with that is it's not a very good medium to long-term strategy, right? Because lots of times there are things you have to talk about because they're not going to go away. And the advantage to having a well-socialized disagreeable person is that they really don't let much get in their way. So if you can get a kid who's disagreeable socialized, that person can be quite the creature, you know, because they're very forward moving in their nature and very difficult to stop. But if you don't get them successfully domesticated, tamed, roughly speaking, by the time they're four, their peers reject them. And that's a big problem, because your job as a parent is to make your child socially desirable by the age of four. Like you want to burn that into your brain, because people don't know that. That's your job. And here's why. It's easy if you think about it carefully. So you imagine you've got a three-year-old child, so sort of halfway through that initial period of socialization, and you take that child out in public. Okay, what do you want for the child? Who cares about you? What do you want from the child? You want the child to be able to interact with other children and adults, so that the children are welcoming and smile and want to play with him or her, and so the adults are happy to see the child and treat him or her properly. And if your child's a horrible little monster because you're afraid of disciplining them or you don't know how to do that properly, then what they're going to do is they're going to experience nothing but rejection from other children and false smiles from other parents and adults. And that's so then you're throwing the child out there into a world where every single face that they see is either hostile or lying. And that's not something that's going to be particularly conducive to the mental health or the well-being of your child. If your child can learn a couple simple rules of behavior, like don't interrupt adults when they're talking too much and pay attention and try not to hit the other kids over the head with the truck any more than is absolutely necessary, then and share and play properly, then when they meet other kids, the kids are going to try out a few little play routines on them, and that's going to go well, and then they're going to go off and socialize each other for the rest of their lives. Because that's what happens, is that from 4 years old onwards, the primary socialization with children takes place among other children. And so if the kids don't get in on that early, they don't move into that developmental spiral upwards and they're left behind. And you can imagine how terrible that is, because a four-year-old will not play with another four-year-old who's two. But a five-year-old certainly will not play with a five-year-old who's two, right? Because the gap is just starting to get unbelievably large. And so the kids start out behind, and then the peers leave them behind, and then those kids are alienated and outside the peer group for the rest of their life. Well, those are the ones that grow up to be long-term antisocial, right? They're already aggressive. It doesn't dip down. Now, what happens to normal boys, roughly speaking? Imagine the aggressive two-year-old types. They get socialized, so their level of aggression goes down, and then they hit puberty and testosterone kicks in, and bang, levels of aggression go back up. And so that's why males are criminals between the ages roughly of 16 and about 25. So, and it matches the creativity curve, by the way. It's so cool. If you look at the spike of creativity among men, 16 to 25, then it starts to go down. Criminality matches that absolutely perfectly. So that's quite cool. So the testosterone levels raise the average level of aggression among men. It's more dominance than aggression, actually. And testosterone is by no means all bad. And then it starts to decrease at about age 25 or 26, which is usually when men stop staying up late at night, stop drinking as much, develop a full-time career, and take on the burdens and responsibilities and opportunities that are associated with a long-term partner and family. It's really useful to investigate the viewpoints of people who have opposing views to yours. Because they'll tell you things, not only will they tell you things you don't know, they'll also tell you how to see the world in ways that you don't see it. And they'll also have skills that you don't have, that you could develop. So, for example, if you're an introverted person, it's very useful to watch an extroverted person, because the extroverted person has ways of being in the social world that aren't natural to you, that you can use as to improve your toolkit. And if you're disagreeable, one of the best things to do with disagreeable people, especially if that's alienating them from other people, for example, because it can, you know, people treat you like you're a selfish, arrogant son of a, maybe that's because you are. It's like, okay, so what do you do about that? One of the most promising treatments, let's say, for that is get the person to do something for someone else once a day, just as a practice, and learn how to do it. Maybe you can wake the circuit up, you know, if you think that it's lying dormant in you, which is probably right. You know, I think we have a very wide range of propensities within us. Some are switched on. Genetic propensity. Some are switched on, but I think that if you put yourself in the right situation or walk yourself through the right exercises, you can switch some of these other things on as well. But it takes work and dedication and discipline. I would say, generally speaking, if you want to adapt yourself properly to life, you should find a niche in the environment that corresponds with your temperament. Right? You shouldn't work at cross purposes to your temperament, because it's just too damn difficult. But having done that, then you should work on developing the skills and viewpoints that exist in the space opposite to your personality, because that's where you're fundamentally underdeveloped. And that way I think you can extend out your temperamental capability across a wider range. And to me, that's roughly equivalent as bringing a richer toolkit to each situation. You know, so if you're hyper extroverted, you should probably learn to shut up at parties now and then and listen just to see what's going on, to see if you can manage it, you know. And if you're introverted, well, then you should learn how to speak in public. And to learn how to go to parties without hiding in the corner and saying nothing to anyone. You know, and if you're agreeable, then you need to learn how to be disagreeable so people can't push you around. And if you're disagreeable, you need to learn how to be agreeable so that you're not an evil son of a bitch. So, and the same thing applies even in the conscientious domain. It's like if you're too conscientious, you need to learn to relax and let go a little bit. And if you're unconscientious, it's time, like, Get out the Google Calendar, man, and start scheduling your day, right? And beat yourself on the back of the head with a stick until you're disciplined enough so that you can actually stick to something for some length of time. You know, people are aware of the future in ways that animals aren't, or animals are only partially aware. We're very aware of the future and aware of our mortal limitations in a manner that seems unique to human beings. And we constantly sacrifice the present to the future. That's actually the definition of work. And that emerges very early on in the biblical narrative corpus, the idea that humans are destined to work, but that also work is the sacrifice of the present. And that's part of the fall in some sense. It's the sacrifice of the present to the future. And we regard that as the hallmark of maturity fundamentally, right? Can you delay gratification? Well, if the answer is no, it's, well, then you're two. Can you delay gratification? Well, then I mean that technically, because 2-year-olds can't delay gratification, which makes it very difficult for other people to play with them, for example. If you can delay gratification, then you can work. If you can work, then you're mature. It's the definition of maturity and responsibility. And it does pervade. It's so interesting to see that it pervades the act of attention itself, and that there's no, because, you know, I used to ask my students, because I was trying to figure this out, I'd ask them a question like, well, why are you writing this essay? Or what are you doing when you're writing this essay? That's a better question. So you think, what is someone doing when they're writing an essay? And one answer is, say they're doing it on a computer. Well, they're moving their fingers up and down. And that's actually a really good answer, because that's not an idea, right? Moving your fingers up and down, that's not an idea. That's where your spirit meets your body. You're actually moving something physical. And you don't really have consciousness of the musculature, or, you know, you don't know how you move your fingers, but you can do it. And so at the highest level of resolution, when you're writing an essay, you're moving your fingers. And now you know how to type, and you have automated structures for doing that. And then you're composing words, and the words are in phrases, and the phrases are in sentences, and the sentences are in paragraphs, and the paragraphs are in sections, and the whole thing makes an essay. But then that's a subset of a class, and you want to grade for the class because you want to pass the class because you want to get your degree. But why do you want to get your degree? It's, well, maybe you're interested in that field of study and you think being a scholar is a good thing and you want to have a job. And so while you're writing an essay, what are you doing? Preparing to have your career? And then are you doing that because you want to be a good citizen and a good father, perhaps a good mother? And do you want to do that because you want to be a good person? And, or are you mixed up in all of that? So you're doing all of those things well or badly at the same time, all the time, with everything you do, all the time. And there's no way around that. It can't be simplified. The whole structure has to be there. And that's another reason why we don't have general purpose robots yet, is that they're just not embedded in that ethic that stretches all the way up from the most minute motor patterns of action and perception to the highest possible ethical striving.
Realize that in order to exist in the world, you're constantly having to sacrifice. That is, you have to sacrifice the idiosyncrasies in order to be able to grasp the object, because this can be all kinds of things, right? It could be a dog's chew toy, it could be a million things. But in order to be able to grasp it, I have to sacrifice the idiosyncrasies. And I also have to somehow, let's say, recognize it in its highest form, or kind of move it towards its highest form. And that seems to be an aspect of religious thinking, which is actually part of attention, which is sacrifice.
Well, the sacrificial aspect of attention in part is that whenever you see something as that thing, you sacrifice the possibility of all the other things it could be. And that's delimiting to a large degree. You know, it hems you in, but that's also a relief, because, you know, how many bloody million things do you want to attend to at one time? But so part of the reason, you know, the idea of sacrifice, conscious idea of sacrifice, emerges very easy early on, for example, in the biblical writings, because the second story in Genesis, I think it's Genesis 3, is that the Cain and Abel story? Genesis 3 or 2?
After Genesis 3. Genesis 4, I guess.
4, okay. So it's very early on, and there's this insistence that, so human beings are already destined to work, as a consequence of the fall out of the Garden of Eden. But the Cain and Abel story is specifically about sacrifice and about the degree to which a sacrifice has to be of the highest quality. So you have this one protagonist, Abel, who's a prototype for a mode of being that stretches throughout history. And Abel's sacrifices are to the highest, to that which is the highest imaginable. So he's aiming as high as he can. And they're genuine and honest. And the consequence of that is that God smiles upon him, let's say, but that his life is extremely successful. He gets everything that a sensible human being would want and need. And he's contrasted with Cain, who's bitter and arrogant and makes second-rate sacrifices. And you want to think about that personally. It's like, well, did you give it your best shot when you failed? And if the answer is no, it's like, well, who are you trying to fool exactly? You're trying to fool yourself? Well, good luck with that. You're trying to fool other people? It's like, well, who made you so smart and them so dumb? And is that how you think about other people? You can just pull the wool over their eyes? And then is it more than that? Do you think you can bend the structure of reality? And so you're going to make these half-witted sacrifices and that's going to please God too? And that's what you believe? And, you know, Cain is very annoyed that his sacrifices aren't being rewarded, and he goes and talks to God and basically calls him out and says something like, you know, kind of stupid cosmos did you make here? Here I am breaking myself in half and all the good things are going to Abel. It's like, what's up with you? Which is really quite the thing to do, you know? And if you don't think people do that, you don't know much about them. And God basically tells them, well, people do that all the time, which is why it's an archetypal story. And God basically tells Cain that he doesn't make good sacrifices. He knows that perfectly well, that he was tempted by bitterness and arrogance and deceit to enter into a consensual sexual relationship with the spirit of vengeful sin itself, which is a hell of an accusation.
Think of a basketball player. I like to always bring it to something that at first not religious at all for people to see what we're talking about. The basketball player has to one sacrifice million things that all his friends are doing that are fun or that he could be doing. He has to take away all the idiosyncrasies and focus on one thing. Mm-hmm. And then that's when the Abel sacrifice comes in. He has to give his best. Mm-hmm. If he doesn't give his best, then he won't make it. There's mm-hmm. no way. And so the sacrificial pattern enters into pretty much any type of excellence or excellent behavior.
You know, one of the things human beings did, because we were preyed upon and became predators, one of the things we did was imitate the predator, you know? And so we were in awe of a predatory animal, like we still might be if you meet a grizzly bear in the woods, you know? It's, you might freeze and you're certainly going to attend to it. But then there's part of you that is deeply called upon to imitate the capacity for aggression of the predator so that you can defend your loved ones against predatory action. And some of that would be to be the warrior that can fight off the grizzly bear, but then abstracted up into the religious sense, it would be to be the ethical actor who can protect your family from unscrupulous psychopaths, you know, forces of malevolence that border on the satanic. And that's all part of the ethical enterprise. And weirdly enough, all of your acts of perception are necessarily nested inside a structure that's pointing to what is at the highest, or you're incoherent. Those are the options. Well, that's a strange thing, right? Because you can say, well, maybe your hierarchy of value isn't unified and there's nothing at the top. It's like, okay, it's not unified. Well, then you're confused. And if you're with someone and your hierarchies of value aren't unified, then you are in conflict. Or you're aimless, or you're hopeless, or you're anxious, or you're lost. That's the phenomenological consequence of lacking this united pyramidal ethic. So you can't get away from the necessity of this unless you want to live, you know, aimless, nihilistic, confused, hopeless, all of that.
Why do you think there is such a crisis of masculinity in the first place? And why are there so many people out there who are angry at you for even talking to men?
Well, I think you could think about it as a consequence, in some sense, of the lack of a concept of original sin, oddly enough. I mean, people bear an existential burden, you know. It's an intrinsic part of life to feel guilty in relationship to nature and to feel guilty in relationship to culture. You know, it's difficult for us to live in harmony with the natural world, and for the natural world to live in harmony with us, by the way. And none of us are all we could be on the social front. And one of the consequences, and so we have that sense intrinsically, you know, that there's a lack in us that needs to be redressed. And unfortunately, that can be weaponized and has been. And what I see happening to young men in particular, boys as well, not just young men, and maybe even, you know, maybe starting at the age of toddlers, is that we have this sense in the world that human beings live in antagonism to nature, and that we're actually a malevolent force, and that our social structures, which are clearly capable of the commission of atrocity, are fundamentally oppressive, patriarchal in their nature. And so then if you're a male in a society with that ethos, you're the motive force that drives you into the world to live is associated with rapaciousness and despoilation on the natural front, and then oppression and atrocity on the social front. It's like, well, then if you're the least bit conscientious, because this sort of accusation hurts conscientious young men the most, then the best you can do is, well, let's say castrate yourself. How would that be? And that would be real comical, except that it's also happening. So I guess that's why I think there's a crisis. And there's something serious at the root of it, right? Because we do have to take the fact of the potential damage we can do to the natural world and the social world. We have to take that seriously, but the proper consequence of taking that seriously is not to commit harikiri, let's say, in a fit of moral anxiety and take yourself completely out of the game. But that's the insistence now, and it's really, and I see that psychoanalytically, you know, I see that as a manifestation at a symbolic level of something like, well, symbolically, that's associated with the devouring mother, right? It's an overweening and destructive false compassion that has this devouring quality. And yeah, and that's basically where we're at. The thing is, I never really set out to talk to men specifically, but I did set out, at least in part, to make a case for the utility of both the feminine and the masculine spirit. And it turned out that making the case for the masculine spirit was something that was more demanded by the culture, let's say. The anger, that's a complicated issue. We touched on some of it in relationship to the despoiling of nature and the idea of the oppressive and atrocity committing patriarchy. But then there's another issue too, which I think is germane. Because of family fragmentation, there's a very large number of women who have, just like there's a very large number of men who have never had a real word of encouragement in their whole life. It's a really sad thing to see. It's a really, really sad thing to see that deeply and to have seen that reflected in so many thousands of people. But there are many women who've never had a positive relationship with anyone male in their life. And so one of the consequences of that, we know, for example, that younger women are more likely to be attracted to men who show dark triad traits, narcissistic, Machiavellian, and psychopathic. And people who have those traits are characterized by the mimicry of competence. And so what women want in men more than anything else is competent generosity, and the data on that are very clear. But you can mimic that if you're narcissistic, and if you're a young woman, you can be deluded by that. It's partly because it points to the problem of dissociating competent confidence from the expression of power per se. So we could call power, I'll define that as the willingness and ability to use compulsion to attain your aims,
Now, if you are someone who has a proclivity to manifest power, then that looks like the manifestation of both ambition and will. And if you haven't had a positive relationship with anyone masculine in your life, and maybe with not even with your own internal masculinity, say, you can't discriminate between power and competent, the ambition that serves competence. And so because that's terrifying, because the power, if you have had only negative relationships with men, their capability to use power becomes such a threat that it has to be opposed at all costs, even if it manifests itself within the, say, within the developmental pathway of your own son. And so some of that's familial breakdown, and then you have a multi-generational pattern of that, and that makes it even worse. And so that's definitely part of it. You know, there's an ideological drum that's being beaten constantly, both on the sociological constructivist front, right? That's the oppressive patriarchy, and then on the environmental front. And then you add to that the fact that, well, on the leftists, especially the radical types, their whole damn doctrine, it's the most pathological doctrine you could invent if you set out to invent a pathological doctrine. And I mean that, I'm not making a joke. I really mean that in the deepest possible sense. The notion that the fundamental human motivation is the willingness and ability to use compulsion, power. Power. It's all about power. And every time I hear that now from someone, I think that is not a sociological observation. That is a confession on your part. And so, and it's also just complete bloody nonsense. I mean, you all know this. You have friends because they're compelled to be your friends. Like, that's definitely not how you have friends. You might have bully henchmen that way, but you don't have friends. Power is an extraordinarily unstable basis to establish a marriage on. Plus, it just doesn't work, because it turns out that women, who are so annoying, are very difficult to oppress, you know? So you can try, but it's not that easy. And I don't think that we've been all that historically successful in doing so. But it's also a preposterous proposition, because the expression of power within an intimate relationship does not produce intimacy or a relationship. The best it can produce is like a combination of tyranny and slavery, and that does not characterize the institution of marriage per se. And I've been trying to puzzle out, especially in my lecture tour recently, what the antithesis to power is, or to the will to power, let's say, in terms of arbitrary compulsion. And it's something like the spirit of free and voluntary play. And that's a wonderful thing to know. It's so optimistic. We guys were talking about optimism earlier, you know. So imagine this, is that if you structure your relations optimally, and I mean optimally, with yourself, with your intimate partner, with your family, with your community, the highest level of attainment of that structuring is the manifestation of the spirit of voluntary play. And that's so lovely, because there's nothing better than playing fundamentally. And you know, human beings and other mammals as well also have a biological circuit that mediates play. That was discovered by a man, Jaak Panksepp, and he showed that play is unbelievably important to the development of children for a variety of complicated reasons, partly because they're practicing to be competent adults, but also that it can be suppressed by almost any other emotion or motivation. So your kids can't really play if they're hungry or tired or wet or upset. The same would apply within your relationship. If there's stresses and tensions, the play disappears. But if you optimize the relationship and the circumstance, then the spirit of play can manifest itself. And I would also say that's also the fundamental purpose of fathers, in some sense, is to imagine that paradise, that's a walled garden. That's what paradise means. So it's walls, structure, and then the garden inside is nature, and a nature that's tended. The masculine role in child rearing is something like the erection of the walls so that play can manifest itself within the walls. And that's a real good combination of security, because that's what the walls are for, but then the kind of freedom that allows for untrammeled development to occur in the most positive possible sense. And so I would say that those of us who are standing against the radicals who insist that the only human motivation is power can oppose that in part by putting forward the observation that the proper antithesis to that is the spirit of voluntary play.